Please court, counsel. Once again, thank you for your indulgence. With the weather, as far as the statement of the case, as court is aware, Clarendon County District Court, per Judge Lammons, entered permanent orders July 22nd, 2011. Both parties thereafter filed Rule 59 motions on the primary issue of mathematical error in the determination of quote-unquote marital equity in the home, although the court is aware that it is the appellant's position that the district court incorrectly determined the amount of marital equity as opposed to separate property in the home. As a result of those Rule 59 motions, the district court corrected its permanent orders as far as the amount of marital equity and stated that that amount should have been $80,418. However, without explanation, as set forth in the original permanent orders, the court equally divided any marital equity in the home. The $58,000 original number the court arrived at. Thereafter, in the Rule 59 order, the first one to come out, the court, without explanation, reduced Mr. Krejci's share of the marital equity to $22,000 of the $80,000 amount. Thereafter, wife filed a second Rule 59 motion, believing that in essence, a new final order had been entered that allowed her a second Rule 59 motion. Essentially, the trial court therein, in its order, stated without findings that the court does not have to divide marital equity equally and affirmed its $22,000 award to husband. Notice of appeal followed. This court entered a show cause order on the Rule 59 motion issues. Both parties responded, and the court discharged the show cause order, and the appeal proceeded. Very briefly on the facts, the parties purchased this marital home in March 2001 as a joint asset. In September 2006, wife's mother took $213,000 of her own funds and paid off the joint mortgage through her financial advisor. Interestingly, in the permanent orders entered by Judge Lammons, he took pains to state that he felt it was relevant that wife's mother paid the amount directly through the mortgage company, although the relevance of that statement is really not clear in the order. In November 2006, wife's mother created the trust. Therein, in the trust document that was admitted at trial, wife's mother stated that gifts during the marriage to her child, gifts during mother's lifetime to her daughter were essentially advancements on her future inheritance, and specifically stated that the mortgage payoff of the joint home was an advancement on that. Obviously, it's appellant's position that the entire amount of equity in the marital home was marital property, as it was a jointly titled asset. Now, I will acknowledge that there is no case law regarding gifts from third parties or relatives to a marriage and a jointly titled asset. However, we believe that the case law extending from Moncrief to Stumpf is synonymous in that when a spouse places a title to a home, for instance, jointly, then it is presumed that a gift to the marriage has been made. Likewise, if a spouse places inherited or gifted funds into a joint account, it is a presumed gift to the marriage, and essentially the only exception to that is, was it excluded by a valid agreement of the parties? So in this case, there was no evidence that once wife's mother paid off the mortgage on the jointly titled asset, that Mr. and Ms. Krejci had some kind of separate agreement that that money would remain her separate property.
Mr. O'Brien, is this really a factual question as for the trial court to determine whether Mrs. Krejci's mother intended to make the gift to just her daughter or to both your client and Mrs. Krejci?
Well, I believe because of the, we certainly have case law on the intent of a donative gift and when that gift is consummated, So is it a factual question? I think it's both a factual and a legal question. Factually, it's no doubt that it was gifted to a jointly titled asset between Mr. and Ms. Krejci. At the time of the gift, there was no expression of her intent that it goes solely to the wife.
Right, but wasn't there testimony, both you, conflicting testimony, I believe, from your client and Mrs. Krejci as to what the intent was, as to whether it was to go to the marital estate or just to the daughter as separate property?
Well, I think it was always Mr. Krejci's position legally that it was gifted to the marriage. As far as Ms. Krejci's position, honestly, it would be speculation because her mother was deceased at the time of trial. As far as what her mother intended, there was no documentary evidence. There was no other evidence other than Ms. Krejci's testimony that she felt it was to go to her.
Was her testimony just based on her impression, or was it based upon conversations she had had with her mother?
Well, conversations with her mother, I don't believe, came in. Conversations between the financial advisor and the mother regarding mother's intent as far as what she told the financial advisor was excluded as hearsay. So I don't think there was really a clear picture at the time the gift was made about what mother intended, other than the factual evidence that it was given to a jointly titled asset to pay off.
Oh, and then with regard to Mr. Krejci's testimony, was that just based upon his belief, or was that based on conversations he had had with his mother-in-law or with a financial advisor?
I don't believe there was any testimony by Mr. Krejci to that effect.
Okay.
The conversations with the mother, I don't believe there was a lot of communication in the whole family picture there. And I don't think there was any testimony whatsoever that he talked to the financial advisor.
Thank you.
How exactly did the mortgage get paid off? Did the mother just write a check and send it into the mortgage company, or what exactly happened?
Mother went to her financial advisor and directed the financial advisor to write a check to the mortgage company to pay it off, approximately $213,000. Thereafter, once again in November, that's when the trust document was created. Now, in Stump, division of this court explicitly kind of affirmed Moncrief's position that transfers from sole ownership in a marriage to joint ownership is specifically excluded from the exception of gifts pursuant to statute. Now, certainly this court could, if it felt the need to, make the same conclusion when a gift or a payment is made from a relative or a third party to a jointly titled asset, that a presumed gift would be made. A presumption would once again, as set forth in Stump, essentially take effect if there was a valid agreement established between the parties to exclude that as marital property. I don't think it's necessarily critical for the court to go down that road, considering that we also have the case law on donative intent, such as Davis v. Love, that the gift is perfected at the time that the donor loses control of the property. And there's no doubt that when wife went to her financial advisor in September and directed her to pay off the mortgage, that the wife's mother lost control of those funds at that time.
Is it your position that there is no contemporaneous evidence of the mother's intent other than what she did through the financial advisor, and therefore, if we apply the presumption you're urging, that's the end of the inquiry?
That's correct.
Thank you.
So we are essentially saying, yes, it was not relevant what she put forth in that trust document 2.5 months later. There was some argument in brief by wife that whether or not mother knew that the home was jointly titled. That's speculation. Once again, going back to the Judge Webb's question, we believe that it was perfected at the time, and it is as simple as that it was paid down on a jointly titled asset. Wife's mother certainly had other options available to her. She could have kept the funds in her own safekeeping, in her own accounts with her own financial advisor. She could have opened a joint account with wife to protect those funds from future divorce proceedings, or she could have simply gifted it to wife and instructed wife to open her own sole account in that event. Had there been appreciation in that those funds, that would have been an issue for marital property division. But it's our position that there was no evidence that at the time the gift was made that it was intended solely for wife. And with all due respect to wife and her counsel, their argument is somewhat, well, mom is deceased now, and therefore the only evidence before the court to determine what her intent was that trust document that came out in November. Going back to the court's question once again, we don't believe that's true, that the evidence as it existed in September of her intent was that it be to a jointly titled asset and a gift to both parties. And that when she came out with that trust document stating that this was an advancement on wife's inheritance, that was really an accounting. Wife ended up, to my knowledge, being the personal representative of her mother's estate, but that was simply a statement put out there that, by the way, I've already advanced this amount to my daughter, and that needs to be taken into account once the estate is distributed. Obviously, it's our position that all equity in that home should be declared marital property, and it should be remanded for future proceedings.
Let me ask you about that. What are the future proceedings that you want us to remand for?
We'd ask this court to determine that there is at least a presumption that wife's mother gifted those funds to the marriage, okay, and that it remand with instructions to the district court. It's as if I own a house and I get married and I put my wife's name on the title, okay? Obviously then, it's marital property. If I'm going to court with a client, I have to concede to the court it's marital property. But then, am I saying that the court is bound by that to make a 50-50 distribution? Certainly not. The court is then required to go make an equitable distribution of the marital property. Wife retains her argument on remand because she can still argue that it's not equitable that this be divided 50-50. Mr. Krejci didn't contribute. My mother contributed these funds. It's equitable. I receive a greater proportionate share.
What's the it that you're talking about? Are you asking for on remand a total review of the property distribution?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Other more minor issues, we believe there was evidence, and if the court remands on entire property division, this is certainly something the trial court can take up, and this court does not need to address in its opinion. But we believe there's the Merrill Lynch account established during the marriage, primarily with inherited funds. Mr. Krejci's name was on that account for a time being. He took his name off that account. I certainly acknowledge there's case law out there that says that in his doing so, he very well could have waived his right to argue that that is marital property. However, we believe there was evidence before the court to show that there was appreciation in that account from the time he removed his name from it to the time of trial. Finally, there's a minor issue regarding child support. I certainly acknowledge that the court is not going to overturn a child support order unless it's manifestly unfair, arbitrary, and the factual findings on imputation of income are not disturbed unless clearly erroneous and not supported by the record. It's simply our position that we felt that court should have made additional findings about why wife should not be imputed income over and above her 58% weekly, 58% of a 40-hour week, and that there were dividends out there that fall within the statute as per gross income, and the court should have considered that.
Now, imputed income and involuntary underemployment were argued to the lower court.
Right? I agree with that, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay, well, doesn't his finding, isn't it implicit that he rejected that argument since he went with the actual income?
I have that right in my notes. I would acknowledge the court could find, this court could find that it was implicit, yes. I would acknowledge that. If the court doesn't have any other questions, that's all I have at this time.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm Teresa Locke. I represent the appellee, Emily Creechy, who was the petitioner in the trial court case, the appellee in this case. She also made some conditional cross appeals, but I don't intend to spend any time on that today unless the court has specific questions, as those cross appeal issues are really conditional only if it gets remanded for division of property, a different division than the trial court held. The three issues that I intended to address today, first one has to do with the marital residence. The second one had to do with, I was going to go out of order, had to do with the Merrill Lynch account, because I think it's important that the court hear about that. And the third one would have to do with child support. Picking up where there were some factual issues with respect to what husband's counsel had indicated, Judge Webb, you're exactly right that this is gift is a fact issue. It was Judge Webb that said it. It is a fact issue as to the donor's intent of that gift with respect to the mortgage being paid off. To correct a factual issue, the funds were actually wired from the Merrill Lynch wife's mother's Merrill Lynch account directly to Chase Mortgage Company. So there was never a check that was given to wife to hand to the mortgage company or any such thing. It was directly wired. There was testimony actually from wife at the hearing that was not objected to as hearsay, related to what the mother's intent was. And on page 40 and 41 of the first day of the hearing, the May 10th, I think it is, 2011 testimony, wife testified that mother had indicated to her that this was a gift to her paying off the mortgage, that it had to do with wife's mother's own childhood and the wanting to have her daughter and her son to have a secure place to live. And that testimony is in the record and was in front of the judge, the trial judge, when he made his determination.
Now, when you say her son, you mean her biological son, correct. Not the husband.
That's correct. She had wife, and then she had wife's brother, and she paid the mortgage for both of her biological children. Ms. Kruger, who was the Merrill Lynch account representative, also testified, and while some of her testimony was excluded as hearsay, the important piece was not. And in fact, on page 159 of the trial transcript for the first day of the hearing, Ms. Kruger testified over objection of hearsay, the court ruled it was not hearsay, that wife's mother did not mention the husband when she was making the payment, that she was concerned about her daughter. The best evidence really is, on top of those two pieces of evidence, the best evidence is the trust agreement. And the fact that it occurred 2 months after the gift doesn't change the fact that the gift was, at the time, related to only the daughter, who is the wife in this case. All the trust document is doing is recounting what happened and indicating that intent. And the trust document itself is an important document for the court to look at. It was marked as an exhibit, and it particularly, let me step away for a moment. In particular, on the part where the wife's mother was indicating who the gift was to, well, first of all, I would say that John Creechy, the husband's name, is not mentioned one time in this 20-some page document. It mentions that the gift was given 2 months earlier to wife to pay off the home, and in the very same paragraph she says, I want my son's Seth's home to be paid as well. The next page of the document, the trust agreement, page 6, which is in the record at page 1051, is important because there's a section related what happens if the beneficiaries are deceased. And John Creechy's name is not mentioned in there either. In fact, wife's mother lists her own brother as the next beneficiary of mine if son and daughter are deceased, and then the Humane Society. She didn't mention John Creechy at all And this was drafted when they were married. There was no marital problems going on.
Let me come back, if I could, to try to distinguish issues of law from fact.
Sure.
What is your position on whether the so-called marital presumption or presumption of marital property applies here in the first instance before we get to factual questions about intent?
I do not believe that the marital presumption applies. I believe that the fact, it's a fact issue as to a gift and was the gift made to.
Okay, and the marital presumption doesn't apply because the donor was a third party as opposed to one of the parties to marriage.
And I believe that there is a difference between those because.
Can you cite to any authority, including out of state authority, that has drawn such a distinction?
I do not look for out of state authority. I would say that there is no Colorado authority on the issue. But logic tells us that when but all the Colorado cases talk about if a spouse gifts it to the other spouse, and logic would tell us that the spouse obviously knows everything about them.
No, I understand. Okay, so your position is there's no presumption, therefore it's a pure factual inquiry as to donative intent.
Correct.
All right. Did the trial court make a factual finding on donative intent, or did he just treat it as separate property without any intent analysis?
It's implicit in his finding that he found the donative intent. He cites to the trust document.
But he did not apply the presumption.
He did not apply the presumption.
So there's potentially at least a legal and a factual issue here.
There is potentially, if the court believes that.
Well, yeah, I asked a poor question. I apologize. Were we to conclude that some variation of the presumption would apply, then remand for findings as to whether the presumption had been overcome would be required because the court didn't consider the presumption applicable in the first place.
I believe that would be correct.
Thank you.
Yes.
I apologize, Judge. I think I interrupted you.
Oh, that's okay. What is your response, Ms. Locke, to Mr. O'Brien's position that the trust document is irrelevant because the donative intent is formed as of the time that the gift is made?
I think this is evidence of what the donative intent was at the time the gift was made. So if we have no, I believe we do have evidence because I believe Ms. Creechy's testimony and the financial advisor's testimony count. But setting aside that, you can have evidence that indicates what the intent was at the time. There was a 2-month passage of time. Presumably the trust agreement was being drafted. It's a 20-page, pretty complicated legal document. So it can indicate that that's what her intent was at the time. And given why she was doing it and how she laid it out in the trust document, I believe it clearly does indicate what her intent was 2 months earlier. Now, I want to turn for a few minutes to the Merrill Lynch account. Let me back up for just one moment to say, with respect to the $80,000 that the court did find as marital property of the house, of the marital residence, the court found that $213,000 was separate property as a result of the gift from wife's mother, and $80,000 was marital property to be divided between the parties. And the court indicated that he was dividing it equitably, if not equally. And the court in other parts of the order awarded husband almost $152,000 of retirement and health savings account, awarded wife $104,000. So the court made an equitable distribution of the total funds, even if it was not splitting each particular asset in an equal fashion. Now we move to Merrill Lynch. So there's a question regarding the Merrill Lynch account of wife's. Again, the standard of review is extremely important in this issue, just as it was in the first issue, because questions of fact are entitled to deference as long as there's support for them in the record. And just like there was support in the record for the trial court's determination that the gift from wife's mother for the residence was to the daughter, not to son-in-law. There's also evidence here that that the gift to, of the Merrill Lynch account was initially from wife's mother to wife through the trust document, and then the second chunk of money that was deposited was from wife's brother when he passed away. And the findings of fact by the trial court are, again, entitled to deference unless there's no support in the record. Husband tried to argue there was disputed testimony about husband's name being on that account and why it was there and how it got there. And the court implicitly found that wife's testimony regarding that was more persuasive or credible. And the court found that the money in the account was not gifted by wife to husband because husband's name was on the account for some period of time. Then the question becomes, okay, so there was an issue regarding growth in the account. And there were actually three different orders that the court issued permanent orders. There was a factual error regarding when wife's mother passed away. So wife filed a motion to correct, a Rule 59 motion. The court corrected it. Then it was actually husband who filed the second Rule 59 motion. So with respect to that, so the court had three opportunities to look at everyone's argument, of all the facts in this, and that wife's position was and is today that just as in In Re the Marriage of Powell, which is 220 P second or P third 925, the court should look at the inheritance as a whole as opposed to parsing out the pieces of the cash inheritance. And when doing that, the evidence demonstrated that wife's inheritance in the various cash forms actually had a negative, it did not increase in value during the course of the marriage. It actually decreased in value during the course of the marriage. And therefore, there was no marital property to split from the inheritance. It was all wife's separate property.
Your position would be that the inheritance essentially constitutes the single asset. Would your position be the same if wife kept half the inheritance in a money market account and bought a house with the other half? Would she still net out the gains and losses?
Not if she bought a house with the other half, but as long as it was a still liquid asset, whether it was in a mutual fund or in a bank account, it is inheritance, just like the IRAs and the retirement accounts in Powell. As opposed to parsing out what each mutual fund was, the court looked at it as a whole and said we should look at the retirement accounts as a whole.
Whether she created two accounts with the inheritance doesn't change the fact that it's still all inheritance.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The final issue had to do with child support, and I think counsel is right that it's a question of fact. The court did look at the underemployment issue and made findings of fact related to Ms. Creechy's efforts to find other jobs, etc. She testified about it. It's in the record in multiple places that we cited in our brief, and the court found the wife's testimony to be credible. And so he's already dealt with the issue with respect to the underemployment. It is a question of fact and should not be overturned unless there's no support in the record, and there was support.
But the trial court didn't specifically find that Mrs. Creechy was either underemployed or not underemployed. Is that correct?
He did not make an explicit finding of that. He made an implicit finding of it, and he recounted what the arguments were. The arguments were clearly before the court at the time, and he cited in his order various pieces of Ms. Creechy's testimony about what she had done to look for employment, and that she was at the same employment level as she had been for the 3 years while immediately prior to the parties separating as well. So while he didn't explicitly use the word she's not underemployed, he certainly made the factual findings that supported that. And the last piece has to do with the dividends, and there was no evidence in the record that there's a guarantee that these dividends would be paid over a period of time. The Ms. Creche saw her, her inheritance as in the Merrill Lynch account fluctuate wildly while the stock market was fluctuating, and there was no guarantee that there would be dividends to be calculated.
Is a guarantee required as a matter of law?
I don't believe it's required as a matter of law, but it certainly is a factual issue that the court can determine whether or not it is certain enough to count as an ongoing income item. So thank you, Your Honors.
Oh. Thank you, Ms. Locke. We appreciate your argument. Mr. O'Brien, you have 11 seconds.
Unless the court has any other questions.
I don't think we have any further arguments, but I want to thank you again for your persistence and coming here in spite of the adverse weather conditions. Thank you again, Ms. Locke. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. And